Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. This is session number 79 tonight. And as we continue to inch our way ever so slowly past the attack under Weathertop, what we've learned, I think, in the attack under Weathertop has been worth our slow pace. I have found it extremely revealing. And in fact, tonight we're going to be starting off with another one of those passages that, you know, looking at it in this context, you know, kind of going through paragraph by paragraph, I'm like, did I ever even notice that before? Like, is that a paragraph I've even read before? It's just, anyway, we'll get there in a second. But anyhow, thanks very much for joining me tonight. I wanted to just start off by saying thanks to everybody who has helped and supported us through our fundraising campaign. We had a wonderfully successful campaign this year. There's still time. If you haven't had a chance to donate yet, you can still do that, of course. Our annual fund is called that for a reason. It's open year-round, but I promise I won't be pestering you about that anymore. Our fundraising campaign is done. So again, thanks everybody who participated in that, and for those of you who attended the webathon, that was really fun. Two quick announcements just before we go. I just wanted to do a couple moot announcements. First, I wanted to emphasize we have two moots that are coming up very soon, including one which is under 2 weeks away now, and that is LA Moot. So you Southern California people need to come out and sign up for that. I'm really looking forward to being out there. It's going to be really cool. We have we're doing the theme of the moot is adaptation. So we're looking at different sort of thinking about different theories of adaptation, challenges to adaptation, approaches to adaptation. Dave Kale and I will both be there. Trish couldn't sadly be there in person, but Dave and I will be there. We'll talk about film some, and I'm going to be giving a talk as well on adaptation, thinking about sort of Tolkien's approach to adaptation. We're going to have a couple panels, folks from theonering.net who are coming out to think about adaptation and think about sort of reflect back on Peter Jackson's adaptations, which should be fun. Anyway, lots of really cool stuff going on at LA Moot. So I hope you guys will be able to join us there in a week and a half. We had a whole bunch of signups here in the last couple days. So glad to see the Southern California people coming out, and hope you can join us there. Second is Magnolia Moot, and that one is coming up 2 weeks later. So LA Moot, October 27th, Magnolia Moot, November 10th, Saturday, November 10th. That's in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I do hope that anybody down there in the South, we'd love to see as many people as we can from the broader region down there, come out and join us for the day. That's going to be at Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte, North Carolina. And it's going to be pretty cool. So anyway, oh, cool, Matt, your research assistant's going to be presenting at Magnolia Moot. That's great. Yeah, anyway, so that's going to be really fun. So I hope that you will, again, go to signumuniversity.org/events, and you can see all of those upcoming events, and that will have also the registration links and stuff. What was the other thing I was going to say about that? Oh, yeah, and of course, for LA Moot also has its own webpage at lamoot.org. Now, the other thing, of course, I announced on Saturday on the webathon, during the webathon, that we announced four new moots that are coming up that will be happening in 2019. In addition, of course, to Tex Moot, which is happening in January, and that's already scheduled and indeed open for registration, we also have four more moots, new ones, that we're planning on starting, and they are going to be in Orlando Moot. I still like Gator Moot. As a name, that's still in my we're talking about names. People were suggesting names at the webathon. Gator Moot still top of my personal list. And then we have Orlando, Gator Moot. We have New England. We're going to be in Amherst, Massachusetts. Still not sure the exact time. Gator Moot is going to be sometime either February or March. Oh, Matt, that research assistant is going to be presenting. Oh, awesome. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Your daughter, that is, she's, yeah. I didn't realize your permanent research assistant. Yeah, of course. I've met her and seen her work many times. So that's great. Awesome. What's she presenting on, Matt? Anyway, okay. So you think Gator will get me sued too? Oh, come on now. They can't possibly prevent people from using the term Gator, can they? my biggest fear of that, I'm like, are we going to offend Florida State alums or something if we call it, you know, Gator Moot? I don't want to seem, you know, prejudiced or anything. Anyway, New England. We're going to be doing New England either late in the spring or early in the fall, one or the other. And then third, we have those two are going to be really great. And we also have two international moots that we're going to be starting up, and that is in the Netherlands. We're doing Nedermoot, probably April or May, date as yet unconfirmed there. But anyway, yeah. So we're going to be going to the Netherlands, and that is essentially the partner corresponding. Anyway, it's parallel to London Moot. So you remember we did London Moot last year in April. Right now, the rough plan is to kind of alternate between the UK and the continent, essentially. So we did the UK last year. We'll do down on the continent this year, and then maybe back to you to the UK next year. That's the rough approximate plan for that. And then our fourth and very exciting one was Kiwi Moot. We're going to New Zealand. So we're having Kiwi Moot. The current plan A, I should say, again, not totally confirmed, but plan A for Kiwi Moot is going to be in November of 2019. Near the end of November 2019. So Thanksgiving week in America. The idea was to do it on a holiday, which is not a holiday locally in New Zealand and Australia, so it won't be a conflict for anybody down there. But the days off in America gives Americans a fighting shot of being able to travel down there if they want to do it. So anyway, it might not work out, but that date might not work out. But it's definitely happening. If it doesn't happen then, it'll probably happen in like January, February of 2020. So in any case, what's the likelihood of it happening again? If you can't make it to Kiwi Moot next year? Oh, pretty good, I think. Yeah, I mean, the one thing I could imagine, you know, kind of like there's several of our regional moots that are kind of traveling a little bit, right? I mean, like we're doing that even in a small way with Middle Moot, which I was just at in Kansas City. That was the same one that was in Iowa last year. So we're kind of moving back and forth between Iowa and Kansas City, kind of moving up and down and catching like the being able to reach the more northerly people and more southerly people every other year. Same thing that we're doing with the UK and Europe. So that, again, we can kind of rotate back and forth to kind of keep from being too heavy of a burden on any of our one local organizers, but also to kind of spread things out a little bit. Maybe, who knows, maybe we'll do something like New Zealand, Australia, for similar reasons, right? To kind of go back and forth and spread that out a little bit. But in any case, JJ, is it going to happen again? Yeah, I don't think this will be our only Kiwi Moot. So yeah, definitely. Cool. So anyhow, those are the moot plans for the coming year. In addition, of course, to continuing to repeat our other moots as well. We plan to do, we'll be going back to LA. We'll be going back to the San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be going back to Middle Moot again, as I mentioned. So anyway, Matt Violinist says, how does one lobby for a destination? Well, send us an email. Well, I would say if you... if you're interested in helping to organize a moot, send us an email at info@signamu.org, and we'll definitely see. Belongsman says donate, also not a bad idea. That would be a good way. Evil Dr. Cannon, see, Mickey Moot is a suggestion, right? that many people have made. And of course, the only reason I'm tempted by it is like in hopes that Disney will sue us. And then, you know, we'll have 400 people at Mickey Moot next year. But apart from that, I don't know. Marianne, you mentioned the Pacific Northwest. That is on my Moot wish list. It really is. I'm thinking about Seattle. Seattle is on my short list of moots I really want to see. Like, I've got a couple places that are really on my short list. Seattle is one. Toronto is another. I really want to get something up in Canada. Good. Darren, yeah, the Morgan exhibit. So I'll have something to announce about that later on. We're doing a kind of a halfway, partway thing with the Morgan. That's been hard to organize, but we're working on something there. Anyway, yeah, Seattle, Toronto, I'd love to do something also more in the north. We're thinking about maybe Ohio, like in that area, to kind of get that sort of north central part of the eastern half of the United States. It's kind of a gap in our Moot structure right now. That's the plan. Oregon would be attractive. Like, I would love to go to Oregon. But Seattle's kind of cool because then for Seattle people, but people can come up from Oregon and come down from Vancouver as well. So Seattle's kind of nicely central in that way. Anyhow, all right. I know, Lady Shmebulak, it would be fun. It would be fun to have more people join me on the Moot tour, right? Going all over the place. Cool. All right. Hey, let's get started. But anyway, so those are my Moot announcements. Don't forget, LA Moot coming up soon. So if you're in Southern California, there are some reasonable excuses, but make sure you come October 27th. Okay, let us begin. So I want to begin with this is going to shock you, right? Prepare to be shocked, because the first thing I want to do tonight is I want to go back and talk more about the attack on WeatherTop. Well, not really. Yes, actually. But it's I keep getting discussion board questions about this, and I definitely got the feeling that there was still some unrest about one of the points here. And so I was really glad that that our friend Old Tolkien Fan raised this. So we're moving forward, right? We got to get past this. It really is an interesting spot, right, for Strider, as you know, they're recovering, and it's like, okay, so step one, everybody lived, right? Great. The ring wraiths did not, they took neither Frodo nor the ring, right? So Frodo's here, still has the ring. He's alive. So this is a win, right? And they've left and they seem to have run away. And okay, so we're doing really well on the one hand, right? On the other hand, it's still a long old walk to Rivendell, and they know where we are and they're on our trail. How are we possibly going to survive for several weeks with the Nazgul hovering around here, right? And Frodo injured. So, this is, you can see how this difficult moment of trying to move past this. Yeah, cool. All right. On to Old Tolkien Fan's question. He quotes at the beginning, it's too long to include it, but he quotes at the beginning. Now, this is slightly cheating, but I thought I would allow it in this case. He quotes Gandalf's analysis, right? When he says, you've been wounded by a Morgul knife, which remains in the wound, right? Now, on the one hand, that's a kind of an easy thing to say when they've just removed a piece of the Morgul knife that was in the wound, right? On the one hand, it's not like necessarily he's saying, oh yeah, there's a subset of Morgul knives, the Morgul knives which remain in the wound, right? Like, they just healed him of, because, and some part of the knife was in the wound. So like calling it a Morgul knife that remains in the wound is just kind of a description of what did happen, in fact, right? Not necessarily, I think, an indicator of like, this is how always they work. But actually, I'm not necessarily opposed to that. Anyway, nevertheless, that, so he quotes Gandalf saying that and then says, if we take Gandalf's answer at face value, having the knife's tip break off and remain in the wound was integral to what the Witch King was trying to do. It was not the accidental result of a botched attack. Perhaps remaining in the wound was necessary for Frodo to be wraithified, as opposed to merely being killed by a knife stroke to the heart. What went awry was that due to Frodo's resistance, the Witch King's attack pierced the shoulder instead of the chest. Given Gandalf's explanation, I've always assumed that the notch in the blade was already built into the edge of the knife. It provides the weak point in the blade where the tip is supposed to break off when the knife is used, and where I assume the tip did break off as planned. Once the blade was broken off at the notch and left in the wound, the knife's evil payload would have been delivered and the knife's magic expended. By the way, that I really like that phrase, evil payload, right? I've delivered my payload of evil, right? Sorry, something about that phrase really just kind of delighted me. And the knife's magic expended, which is why the Witch King dropped the knife instead of repeatedly hacking at Frodo with the broken blade. Okay, there was nothing for him to do at that point but depart. I have also always assumed that to facilitate its breaking, the knife was a thin double-edged stiletto with the physical properties, to the extent that a blade of condensed black magic has physical properties, of a brittle black obsidian glass dagger, not of a tough steel knife that would be unlikely to break even when notched, even if it hit bone. Okay, great. So, I think that there's a lot of good stuff here. So there are couple things that I would say, and so there's some things that I disagree with here, though I know a lot of things that I really like. In particular, I agree that my favorite part of this comment is the bit about the obsidian instead of steel. That's really good. I mean, we see it sort of glowing, right? So we don't even really get any sense of like, does it look like steel that's glowing or whatever? But that idea of this looking like being shaped like an obsidian knife. Like, I can totally get behind obsidian stiletto, right? Which is a little bit unusual, frankly. But anyway, obsidian stiletto as like the general shape and nature of the knife blade, while it's, you know, corporeal and before it fades into mist. So that actually I really liked. Back to Gandalf's quote here. Boomful thinks that Evil Payload would be another good band name. Yeah, actually, it's not too bad. You can see like a death metal band named Evil Payload, I suppose. Evil Dr. Cannon says the Witch King and Aragorn should have battled each other with broken blades. Obsidian Stiletto would be the opening act, clearly, for Evil Payload, right? No question. You were thinking of Obsidian Stiletto, too? Yeah, okay. All right. I don't know. Evil Payload is... I think it's an even better band name, frankly, but I like Obsidian Stiletto. That works. You think that Evil Payload would be the opening band? Oh, I don't know. I don't really know about that. But anyway, okay. Point is, back to Gandalf's quote. So again, when Gandalf says that this was a Morgul knife which remained in the wound, again, he's just describing what did in fact happen, right? So does Gandalf's statement, again, describing what did happen, does Gandalf's statement suggest that in order for Frodo to be wraithified, a piece of the blade would have to remain within Frodo's person, right? So if a piece of that blade, right, enters Frodo's heart and remains in Frodo's heart, then he's wraithified. So like the breaking off is requisite, right? Okay, so does that mean that? I'm not really sure that means that. Right. I can see it moving a couple directions. Right. Towards the heart mostly. No, just kidding. But I don't think that it doesn't seem to me a necessary interpretation, like an inescapable interpretation of Gandalf's words there. Again, it did remain in the wound and it was working towards the heart. does that prove that a sliver of the knife must be in the heart in order for Frodo to be subjugated as a wraith? No, not to me necessarily. Like, if the knife had entered the heart initially, would it have had to break off in order to work? Would it have done? I mean, it could do so again. You can imagine that, right? You can imagine that even if he stabs him in, the tip breaks off and the tip remains straight in the heart, right? Direct delivery to the heart, instant wraithification, game over, right? But for all we know, the mere like stabbing, you know, puncturing of the heart of Frodo with the blade might be enough to do it, right? Which, of course, would be done directly without any need for any shards, right? If he had stabbed him straight in the heart. But given that he was stabbed in the shoulder, it required a sliver to go all the way and burrow in towards his heart in order to make that happen. So, frankly, I can see either one of those things being true. I kind of like the idea of the sort of a shard of the blade remaining in his heart no matter what. I mean, I find that a kind of appealing. I don't find it inevitable, but I find that kind of appealing. I mean, not like personally, but, you know, sort of symbolically. Because remember that as far as we can see, and as old Tolkien fan even acknowledges there in that last sentence, that the blade, as far as we can tell, is like condensed black magic. Right. It seems to be the concentrated will of the Ringwraith, which is why it dissolves. I don't think that either an obsidian blade or a steel blade or any other kind of blade is just going to melt away like that when the sun comes out. Right. I think that it just, and especially again, the way that the hand was glowing as well as the blade suggests that it is the power of the Witch King that was working through this knife, and that the knife is therefore in its sense, in itself, in a sense, just an extension of his will. That's why I like it, the reading, right? That a shard stays in the heart, right? Because then a shard of the blade would be an infiltrated piece of the will of the Witch King lodged, skewering Frodo's heart, either immediately, right, or eventually, one way or the other. The breaking off and the worming its way across from the shoulder seems to be something like a failsafe, and also to fit with the nature of the blade as an extension of the Witch King's will, right? Just because the Witch King missed, thanks to Frodo's brave dive forwards, and hit him in the shoulder instead of the chest, doesn't mean that his will is going to cease to work. His will is going to continue to work. And again, I see the chip, right? The shard of the blade working its way through towards Frodo's heart as being essentially just sort of a way, like a physical outward representation of what we're so like Frodo is coming more and more under the spell of the Witch King, right? We saw the Witch King compelling Frodo with his will, right? With the putting on of the ring. And here, like the ultimate compulsion. And again, you think about the, don't think about, I think it's more important not to think about it physiologically, but to think about it spiritually, right? Remember, this is a spiritual battle from the beginning, right? This is a battle for Frodo's heart. Right. And the Witch King can only fully subdue his heart if he pierces his heart if the Witch King pierces Frodo's heart with his own will. Right. Thereby, you know, killing him. Right. Slaying his own will and subjugating him, subjugating Frodo to the Witch King's will. So. Do I think that the Witch King's weapon, which remember, again, I'm not convinced is a real weapon in the sense of having a blade that was chipped or forged by anybody, is the Witch King's. So the breaking off of the shard or the sliver of it when he stabbed Frodo in the shoulder, this seems to me something like a failsafe, right? That is, again, it's a vehicle for his own will. It's doesn't in that sense, it doesn't really matter whether he hits or misses. It does matter because it will like vary the directness of the strike, right? But, you know, even if he just stabs you in the foot with his Morkul blade, he can still work through that, right? That's why this kind of wound from this kind of weapon, as Strider says right away, is like, I don't know what I can do against this kind of wound, right? So I definitely think that, again, what's important here is the spiritual conflict, right? Is the will of the Witch King working? And I kind of suspect that the Witch King has to be rather actively working at this. Not sure that that sliver of blade in Frodo's shoulder has a will totally of its own, right? And is just like, you know, homing its way towards his heart by some independent, you know, motivation, right? You know, as the product of some spell that the previously cast by the Witch King. Again, I'm not really convinced that that's how that works. Anyway, given that I'm not convinced of the full reality of the blade necessarily, again, I'm not 100% convinced that it's not either, but I lean in that way. I mean, I would say I'm about 70-30 towards it not being a real blade, towards it being a manifestation of the will of the Witch King. In which case, I don't think that the notching has anything to do with the tip breaking off. Because, first of all, I'm not even sure that tip breaking off fits the description. Doesn't Gandalf call it a sliver? Anyway, but it doesn't really matter all that much. If we're thinking about that, like, you know, it's notched so that the tip can break off. I definitely, that seems to me a little too mechanical, right? Again, it's not like you have to rig the thing physically. That wouldn't be how it would work. The breaking off of it, if it is an extension of the will of the Witch King, it's remaining in the wound means the Witch King's, you know, force and energy remains working through that wound to try to continue, or rather to continue trying to conquer the will of the victim, right? So I don't think we have to think about it in those physiological ways. And the second thing, the second reason I'm skeptical, particularly about the notch thing, is, yeah, trifle. I was pretty sure splinter was the word that Gandalf used, which, by the way, was another reason that I liked the obsidian suggestion. But Mad Violence has to be melted, right? So it, pretty challenging to melt obsidian. But anyway, what was I saying? Sliver, notch, right? That's the other thing. I would encourage somebody else to look this up. Look this up if you have time. You could probably do it during class here tonight. Look up the time the word notch, any form of the word notch is used, especially as a verb or participle related to weapons, because it happens. You know, his blade was notched. That's a phrase. Tolkien uses that, I'm pretty sure, multiple times. And I'm going to say, based on my memory, every time Tolkien uses the word notched to describe a weapon, it describes damage done to the weapon. Exactly. Gimli's axe is notched in Helm's Deep. Alas, my axe is notched for the 42nd War and Iron Collar around his neck, right? Exactly. The sword, I believe, also of Baldur in The Path of the Dead is notched, right? And Byam lay a notched sword. Boromir's sword gets notched. Yes, exactly. So when he says that the blade is notched, I don't think there's any precedent for Tolkien using that word to describe like a design feature in a blade. It almost always describes damage to a blade. Now, Karita, I agree. If I were spiritually manifesting a knife, I feel like I'd want it to be perfect, not notched. Agreed. The notch, I wonder, does that suggest damage to the blade? Right? That it, even if it's a spiritual blade, it would have received spiritual damage from that conflict, right? In fact, honestly, I can't think of where exactly, when we were talking about it, is it because it hit bone? Maybe, like the shoulder blade could have notched it, but I'm not really sure. The only thing that seems to notch other notched blades are when you do things like use them on a stone door like Baldur, or hit an iron collar like Gimli, or what was the other one? Oh yeah. Hit a troll, right? Like Boromir. Okay. 8 times Matt. Great. All of which are damaged weapons in battle. Okay. That was my memory. That was my memory of it. Anyway, Mad Violinist, how do we deal with the splinter? By waiting until we get there in the next chapter. That's how we're going to deal with the splinter. I'm already transgressing in bringing in Gandalf's comment, but since it was directly addressing many questions that people had last time, and I still felt we were a little unsettled with that, I was okay coming back to it. Anyhow, okay, so again, I don't buy the idea that it's a design part of the dagger, because again, I don't think it's got to be designed to break in a particular place or anything. Again, I just don't think it's that kind of weapon. What was the last thing I wanted to talk about? There was another thing. I'm forgetting now. Oh, yes, that's right. The dropping of the knife. I absolutely disagree with the dropping of the knife. And the primary reason I disagree, and this I did say last time, but I want to emphasize it again. Both Aragorn and Glorfindel and presumably Elrond are assisted in their treatment of the wound by reading the runes that are written on the hilt of the dagger. In that case, if the Witch King dropped it on purpose, you know, like a one-shot weapon that delivers its evil payload and then is done, and then he drops it. Then he's a fool, right? Because he is leaving something which will help them to heal the wound, which is dumb. Now, again, not saying that he wouldn't do a dumb thing or that a dumb thing wouldn't happen, but I can't imagine that's the plan, right? Yeah, exactly. Finn, if it's a major fail, sure, that could happen, right? And that's ultimately what I think did happen. I think the reason that he drops it is when Frodo drops the E-bomb, right? That's when I was kind of thinking about that today. If I were doing a screen adaptation of the Attack on Weathertop, I would want to represent, especially if I'm showing like Frodo's view, Frodo and the Witch King's view, so that you can see both of them, right? I would show like, you know, the Witch King stabbing down, and then Frodo, you know, Frodo diving forward and Frodo getting stabbed in the shoulder out here. And then right as Frodo is stabbed, he cries out in a loud and clear voice, "I, Elbereth Gilthonio." And as soon as I would have like a flash of white light, emerge, and like the I would have the Witch King not just turn and run away, like, ah, you know, like no, that is the name that the Witch King cannot hear, right? That's not how I would handle that. I would actually have it be like a physical force that throws him away, and he screams. So he screams like, ah, and he drops the, you know, the knife flies out of his hand, and he goes like screaming away, you know, and like, I don't know if I'd make him tumble, that'd be a little indelicate, but I would actually make him hurled out of the way. Matt, maybe I'd make him hurled straight out of his cloak, right? Not in like a Looney Tunes way where his cloak still stays there shaped like a person and then drops to the ground. But again, like, show his cloak ripped off of him and him flung away, you know, the shadowy Witch King flung away by the force of it. I mean, it's a big deal. The saying of the name of Elbereth in that instance. And again, we didn't see what it was like right before. We didn't see the kind of impact that it had, but his scream suggests to me that this is a big, he's not just like nonplussed, right? He's not just discombobulated briefly. More deadly, remember, is the word that Aragorn used to describe to describe the name of Elbereth to the Witch King, right? So that's how I would just to try to convey that's what ended things there, right? And there's not really any question of like, man, the Witch King really fell asleep at the switch. I mean, he was standing right there. His, you know, enemy was lying comatose on the ground with holding the ring in his fist. I mean, like, how easy would that have been, right? Just step on his wrist with your stompy boots, which you're still presumably wearing, right? Take the ring and get, right? Again, a lot of people have that reaction to this scene, but again, that's not an option. And it's not Aragorn with his pointy sticks that is scaring him away at that point. Anyway, okay. So I totally don't buy that he deliberately, that it was a one-shot blade that he then deliberately dropped because it was done. I definitely don't buy that. I think that his dropping that was an accident. Does that mean that it is or is not a one-shot blade? I don't really know. I mean, to me, it's not necessarily that material as to whether or not he could reuse that hilt. Right. Maybe he can. Maybe he can't. Maybe that hilt is like set about with spells so that it's like, you know, a Nazgul darksaber, you know, that he, you know, so that he could do that same thing again and again if he invests the same amount of power in it. Now, it would weaken him. Right. I mean, this is something we talked about briefly last time, and we've seen this time and again when evil people sort of project their power, outwards in that way, that it tends to weaken them. He's trying to capture Frodo, Irindis. Of that, I feel fairly confident that he's not trying to take the ring. But again, lots of people complain that he's like standing there. The ring is literally loose, right, at his feet. I mean, just held in Frodo's hand at that point, in the hand of an unconscious person. Why couldn't he be bothered to stoop down and pick it up? Again, I've heard that objection so many times to this passage. That's why I emphasize that Irindis. But no, I totally think his plan is to take Frodo, not the ring.
For
Thomas, it's interesting to wonder if he would have been capable of taking the ring for himself, if he were capable, you know, Forthalis, as you say, is he capable of that kind of an act of will, because his own will is so enslaved by Sauron? Could he do that? Or is it just that he's been forbidden to, right, by his master, because Sauron doesn't want any part of that? You know, that's the last thing he needs, is that kind of personnel issue, right? Have the Witch King claim the ring for himself, right? It gets all kinds of messy at that point.
Arden Crayon, an excellent question, right? And again, people have asked me that, right? He could, as Arden Crayon says, he's carrying a sword in his other hand, right? Why don't you just chop off Frodo's hand and take the hand, right?
Exactly. No, that's exactly the kind of thing that people ask. But again, my answer to that is he is not in a chopping, stomping, or grabbing state of mind at that point. He is not only reeling, at least running, possibly tumbling, right? Being blown, you know, he's airborne at the time, right? And of course, he's too incorporeal to like leave a crater in the ground when he lands several yards away. But, you know, that's really how I see him being blown back by the E-bomb there. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Lots of people skeptical that the Witch King would be capable, one way or another, capable of taking up the ring, or certainly of claiming it if he did take it up. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to be sure, but you've got to think, right? It's not like Sauron totally trusts the Nazgul personally. Like, I love you guys, right? I know you guys are always thinking of me first, right? That's not what the relationship between Sauron and the Nazgul is like. You gotta think. So if he's sending them after the ring, you've got to think that Sauron is reasonably confident that they're not going to turn it against him, right? I mean, you know, so yeah, I think that's fairly clear. And chopping off hands is just uncouth. I know, right? I mean, like, who would do that other than giant wolves? Yeah. Yeah, Karina, that it is a kind of an interesting parallel, right? That the orcs are ordered not to spoil the hobbits by Saruman, right? Is the Witch King under a similar order? Yeah. Yeah, in a sense, right? I mean, you can kind of see the parallel there, that they, that the Nazgul, okay, so Saruman tells the orcs not to spoil them because he doesn't want them looting the bodies, right? Or living or dead, right? Because, of course, like Gold Ring, right? They'd take it for themselves, obviously. You know, good loot, nice and handy is how they would describe that kind of thing, right? So he doesn't want to then have to go, like, now he's got to go, like, you know, search all the nasty hiding places of all the orcs who, you know, Saruman does not want to have to do cavity searches on, like, all of the Uruk-hai who went on this trip. So he tells them not to spoil the hobbits. It's obviously... You don't have the same issues, right, with the Nazgul. However, that question of trust, right, is that, and I think, you know, Sauron's trust for the Nazgul, I suspect, is higher, but that's because, as Eric Cratcher was just saying on Twitter, they're his thralls, right? I mean, again, I think that's kind of his safeguard here. Right, they are enslaved to his will in ways that the orcs are not. We can see them being uppity, right? And you know, Ugluk keeps order, but you know, there are some who are going to defy that, who are ready to defy it. If he didn't knock off a few heads, Uncommon Fan, you're welcome. You're welcome for that image of Saruman having to perform cavity searches on the orcs. But you know, he would, right? I mean, he'd have to do that. He'd probably come up with a scientific process, right? Like he'd, you know, probably have them boiled or something. And then, you know, if you boil them down for stock, the ring would then drop to the bottom of the cauldron. And then you could just siphon off the orc slop and take out the ring, right? That's probably how Saruman would do it. And he's mind of metal and wheels. Anyway, so how did I get onto this topic? Never mind. Yeah, it would be kind of, never mind. I'm not going to make the comparison. I was just going to make. Okay. totally gotten. It's much better, Uncommon Fan. Good. Yeah. Rendering down orcs for stock is a much, much better image than doing cavity searches. I totally agree. Anyhow, yeah. I think I'm good. Are we good? I know that we don't necessarily all agree. And like I say, you know, with passages like this, it's really hard to be definitive. I mean, there are multiple ways that this could be interpreted. I could totally buy that this was a real legitimate blade. Like it was a, you know, a steel blade or iron, maybe. Iron would be kind of cool. I mean, it would rust. You'd have to, you know, oil it and whatever. But anyway, still, like, I could see... something like an iron blade or even an obsidian blade or even a steel blade, which is, again, magically empowered to do what it does, right? So that the splinter that comes off it is again, splintered off by the will of the Witch King. One way or another. Anyhow, okay. All right. Looks like soup's back on the menu. Oh, man. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so there we are. All right. Let's move on, because that's what the theme of today's class is. So Strider has just come back. He sat down on the ground, and taking the dagger hilt, laid it on his knees, and he sang over it a slow song in a strange tongue. Then, setting it aside, he turned to Frodo, and in a soft tone, spoke words the others could not catch. From the pouch at his belt, he drew out the long leaves of a plant. "These leaves," he said, "I have walked far to find, for this plant does not grow in the bare hills, but in the thickets away south of the road, I found it in the dark by the scent of its leaves." He crushed a leaf in his fingers, and it gave out a sweet and pungent fragrance. "It is fortunate that I could find it, for it is a healing plant that the men of the West brought to Middle-earth. Athelas they named it, and it grows now sparsely, and only near places where they dwelt or camped of old. And it is not known in the north, except to some of those who wander in the wild. It has great virtues, but over such a wound as this, its healing powers may be small. Okay. I'm hearing the enchanting music of me having timed out. Okay, so that first paragraph is the paragraph I was referring to earlier that I always, that, you know, I read this carefully and I'm like, wait, have I ever even read this before? If you had asked me, like, so what does Aragorn do, right, to treat Frodo's wound? I'd have been all about the Athelas, right? I've been like, yeah, obviously, right? He gets the Athelas and he boils it and he bathes the wound and there's the, you know, the aroma and it's good, right? And it's totally about the Athelas. When you actually look at it, Athelas is step three of the treatment process. And the first two steps, I think I've always in my entire life overlooked. He sat down on the ground and, taking the dagger hilt, laid it on his knees and sang over it a slow song in a strange tongue. Now, I'm not sure whether the song that he's singing over the dagger hilt is designed to be diagnostic or prescriptive, right? I mean, is this part of the treatment or is it part of the diagnostic process, right? I'm not sure. Especially like him singing it over the hilt of the blade suggests that he's countering the magic, countering the power of the hilt, right? But I could also buy that he was trying to like assess it, right? That he's like testing it in order to try to understand it better, perhaps. But it definitely sounds like it's, Mudmort, like he's casting identify weapon. I have to admit that that's the kind of thing that I was thinking of there. But I think it's more likely to be him singing against the power of the weapon itself, right? So he has, but it's still interesting to me that the focus is in a sense on the weapon. He's not singing over the body of Frodo. He's singing over the hilt of the knife, right? As if competing with that directly. This sort of makes a lot of sense. I can't help it, of course, but remember, you know, like the fight between Finrod and Sauron in the Silmarillion, right? The song battle between the two of them, and wonder if there's something kind of similar going on here. This, of course, fits especially well with the assertion that I've been making, which is that the knife and the power of the knife is an extension of the will, an active extension of the will of the Witch King. So that when Aragorn is singing over the dagger hilt, he is, in a sense, opposing the will of the Witch King with his own will, right? So this seems to, now is this, I don't think, by the way, you can't rule it out. You can't rule out that singing like this is part of, like, you know, advanced healing process, right? Like if you're a really good healer, you sing, like, you know, so like, really good healers in the houses of healing would be like singing at every bedside, that it would be part of effecting a cure, part of treatment, for, you know, most ills. I can't rule that out, but I tend not to think that that's what's going on here. Again, it's just part of, like, it's what I do as a healer. I sing, like, it's part of my, you know, it's part of my technique, right? I don't think so. I think that's why he's not singing over Frodo. He's singing over the knife, right? He's opposing its will with his. And exactly, Matt, the hilt is where the runes are, the words of power of the blade. And so, yes, I think that he's opposing that. Though, Matt, that's exactly why I was wondering. The other possibility that I was suggesting is that he's trying to reveal the power of those runes so that he can understand it and know how to fight it. But I don't see any evidence in what he does later that he learned anything special from that. So I definitely think that it's I strongly inclined towards its being opposing the will of the knife or the will of the Witch King there as well. Trifle. So briefly, we'll skip really far. Well, I'll skip far ahead in order to just say this. It's the second step, right? The first step is he sings over the blade. The second step, and this I am sure I never really noticed before, or at least never really thought through before. He turned to Frodo and in a soft tone spoke words the others could not catch. Now, I think when I had read that before, spoke words the others could not catch, I understood him as just like chanting a spell of some kind over Frodo. Right. So he's casting some kind of spell. He's uttering some kind of incantation. He's putting forth power to try to help and to heal Frodo, is how I always think. I'm pretty sure that's whenever I have thought about that line, which is obviously not often enough. I think that's how I always understood it. But of course, that's not, I think, what he's doing. He's whispering to Frodo, not over Frodo, right? Not to Frodo's wound, not to the knife, not to the splinter in the wound, not to Frodo's white blood cells. He is singing to Frodo, right? He's turning to Frodo, he's rather speaking to Frodo, words that the others could not catch. Comforting Frodo, possibly. Yeah, exactly. In fact, so this is really funny, right? Not only have I never paid proper attention to that line, but I've often had a question which would have been answered by paying attention to that line, and I never answered it, right? My question was, okay, in the Houses of Healing, with Eowyn and Merry and Faramir, not in that order, the main thing that, the Athelwas comes in, right? But that's not the main thing that he does. The main thing that he does with them is call to them, right? He puts his head on their brows and call. And especially with Faramir, there's that sense that, like, sort of mentally and spiritually, he is like wandering far, trying to call Faramir back, right? As he's calling out his name, which sounds increasingly distant, right? As if he's moving away. The will of Aragorn to call them back to life and have them respond is obviously sort of the central part of the healing process of Faramir, Eowyn, and Merry in the Houses of Healing. So, you know, I read that in The Return of the King, and I'm like, so, why didn't he do that with Frodo? Right? Frodo come on, he got stabbed by the Ringwraith, right? So, I mean, surely he was experiencing the Black Breath, right? So why doesn't he call out to Frodo? Well, he totally does, right? He does exactly the same thing with Frodo in exactly the same order, right? First, he speaks to Frodo words that only Frodo can hear, nobody else can hear, right? And then he brings out the Athelwas, right? Exactly as he does in the Houses of Healing. So, there's every reason to believe that he is doing for Frodo here the same thing that he does, or rather the other way around, right? That when he's in the Houses of the Healing, he's doing what he does for Frodo here. Now it's different and it works differently in the different circumstances. The different circumstances being how far gone they are, Faramir very close to death, right? But also, not only the different circumstances in that way, Merry much more lightly wounded, much, much easier to recall, right, than Eowyn or Faramir were. But also, of course, the different circumstances of them and the state of their hearts at the time, right, the sort of the spiritual condition they were in pre-encounter with the Nazgul. But then also the difference of the circumstance of Aragorn's relationship to them, right? Faramir making that very plain, right? You know, who would lie idle when the king calls? It is clear that he hears the voice of his king calling to him, and so he responds, right? And again, he makes that very explicit. With Eowyn, it's tricky, right? She responds too, But her response is tough. We'll come back to that in several years. With Mary, it's simpler, right? And it seems to be not like I, your king, call you, right? But his old friend Strider, who is calling him. It is to friendship and fellowship that Mary seems to be recalled in the Houses of Healing, right? Now, of course, Frodo and Strider here do not have a very solid relationship, right? I mean, I'm not saying they're not okay, but I'm saying they don't have a long history here. In, you know, what kind of power does he have to be able to call Frodo back? I don't really know, right? But the fact is, that does seem to be what he's doing. Now, we're not told, and we get no indication in this sentence, what are the words? All we know is that nobody else can hear them, right? And I'm guessing maybe Frodo doesn't remember them well enough to, because Frodo's unconscious at the time, right? So he, you know, Sam doesn't hear it, Frodo doesn't remember it, so nobody records what it was that Aragorn called out to him. But anyway, I don't think it doesn't seem to have as dramatic an effect, right, as it does in the Houses of Healing. Partly that's because Aragorn himself is in a different place at that point, but also I think it also kind of has to do with their relationship too a little bit here. But again, the big point is clearly he's doing the same thing, right? The same thing here that he will do in the House of the Healing. And I couldn't even believe it. Just like prepping for class tonight. Again, I was reading that paragraph and I'm like, holy cow, there it all is. Notice how magical? I mean, to use the dangerous word, right, that made Tolkien super uncomfortable. How magical / spiritual, I guess you could really kind of talk about it either way in this instance, Aragorn's treatment plan is, right? Yes, it's about, but it's not just like about the healing qualities of Athelas, right? That's part of it. It's important. It's a healing plant, but it's not just that, right? That's only the third part of the three-part cure. The first part of which is this direct, like, I shall sing a counterspell to your spell, right? Then I will call Frodo in order to, you know, draw him back from the shadow, and then I'm gonna bring out the Athelas, right? Yeah. And JJ, I agree, even the nature of the healing that Athelas brings seems to be as much spiritual as physical. Absolutely. Yeah. There's no indication of a real physical process there. I mean, I'm not saying you couldn't make one, right, or think up one, but that's not the way it's described. The way it doesn't have to be ingested, right? It doesn't heal in that way. It doesn't have to be, he bathes the wound with it, but again, it's not even, especially in The Return of the King, the emphasis is on the effect of the aroma, right? Yeah. Anyway, whoop, sorry. Losing my place here. This is what I meant to do. Okay. Okay, so yeah, I wonder. Aragorn's words for Thomas suggests that over such a wound as this, its healing powers may be small. Suggests that it really can be useful against more mundane injury. Quite possibly. But again, in what way and in what sense, right? Cecilia, what a great point. Let's see, hang on. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I'm looking at what he does with the Athelas here. Okay, he draws out the long leaves and he crushes the leaf in his fingers and it gives out the fragrance, right? Okay, he hasn't even put it in the water yet, but let's keep reading. He threw the leaves into boiling water and bathed Frodo's shoulder. The fragrance of the steam was refreshing, and those that were unhurt felt their minds calmed and cleared. The herb had also some power over the wound, for Frodo felt the pain and also the sense of frozen cold lessen in his side. But the life did not return to his arm, and he could not raise or use his hand. He bitterly regretted his foolishness and reproached himself for weakness of will, for he now perceived that in putting on the ring he obeyed not his own desire, but the commanding wish of his enemies. He wondered if he would remain maimed for life, and how they would now manage to continue their journey. He felt too weak to stand. The others were discussing this very question. They quickly decided to leave Weathertop as soon as possible. "I think now," said Strider, "that the enemy has been watching this place for some days. If Gandalf ever came here, then he must have been forced to ride away, and he will not return. In any case, we are in great peril here after dark, since the attack of last night, and we can hardly meet greater danger wherever we go."
"Yeah, Mike, Frodo's more awake and alert than I was expecting, too. That seems to have totally torched my previous theory that Frodo was unconscious and didn't remember what he said.
Does Frodo just not reveal it? Is he being coy? Is that private? He doesn't want to share what Strider said?"
Yeah, he's... Frodo is more with it than I was remembering there, too, Mike. Belongsbond is wondering if he's singing to the Athelos rather than to Frodo. Wait. Does he sing again? No, he's speaking to Frodo. He sings to the knife. He speaks to Frodo. Then he talks about the Athelos. He crushes it and he puts it in the water. The boiling water. Right, he boils it. Yeah, he makes Athelos tea. An infusion of Athelos. Which is, of course, just what the Herb Master, you know, refers to in House of the Healing. Okay, let's see. Yeah, it's the hilt he sings over. Anyway, okay. Let's look at the power of the herb over the wound. Frodo felt the pain and also the sense of frozen cold lessen in his side. But the life did not return to his arm, and he could not raise or use his hand. Okay. Yeah, Tony, I think you're right. We do get a number of moments where we would really like to know what Frodo's thinking here, right? But he doesn't tell us. That's interesting. That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, Evil Dr. Cannard, it is interesting. Well, it's in his side and his arm, right? So his arm is dead. His arm is dead. And his side had the deadly chill that was spreading down his side? That, I think, is really interesting. This supports my theory. It is still my theory that his wound is on the outer part of his shoulder, like up not far from the joint of his shoulder, and actually like in his arm rather than up like by his collarbone, because his arm is useless, right? I mean, he can't even lift his hand. So the wound seems to have deadened his arm, but the chill spreading to his side, that seems to me to speak to the power of the splinter that's still in it, the power of the Witch King that's still working through the wound and which is working inwards, right? So the chill, the deadly chill spreading down his side refers, I think, would be Frodo's physiological manifestation of that splinter of, you know, the power and will working inwards towards his heart from his shoulder, right? But
And that would also make sense why the chill goes away. So when the pain and the sense of frozen cold lessens in his side, but the life doesn't return to his arm. So his arm is not like unwounded, right? I mean, he's still wounded. The physical wound he's received is still there. And his arm is still dead, but the spreading influence is slowed. Frodo, or the narrator here, attributes, well, it's kind of Frodo, the narrator talking about Frodo attributing, the lessening of the chill in his side to the herb, right? To the Athelas itself. And that seems certainly that it contributed. But again, I'm kind of wondering if that's perhaps step one, that is the song that he sang over the hilt, perhaps might not be as important for that as the Athelas itself. Yeah, and Brandon, I agree that there's... Brandon, before I get to your point, let me just finish that thought there. The spreading of the deadly chill suggests to me that, in fact, the movement of the splinter initially was fast, or at least very much faster, right? If it's spreading already from his shoulder to his side, like, what, minutes, hours at most after the wound, he's probably going to be dead within... what, even if he's tough, right, he's going to be dead within within a couple, like a day or so. And that's in fact exactly what Gandalf suggests, right? That it's a marvel that he wasn't, right? I think we can see the effectiveness of this treatment, of the combination of treatments, the threefold treatment that Strider has given to Frodo here. But anyway, Brandon, now back to your really important point. Frodo's thoughts about his injury are feeling useless and despondent as to what they'll do now. Reproaching himself, right? Feeling guilt and if it were Sam, he'd be using lots of the gaffer's hard names, right? But Frodo still is rebuking himself, right? I agree. I think that that's super important. And notice that there's... that also fits the impact of the will of the Witch King on him. Like, on the one hand, he's having a moment of clarity, right? With his mind cleared by the Athelas and now recognizing in retrospect, yeah, I really blew it back there when I put the ring on, right? I wasn't actually really driving the bus there. I was undergoing compulsion and I totally gave into it, like a wuss. Those are his thoughts, right, about himself. But again, notice that despondency, that self-reproach, that despair. How are we going to manage to continue our journey? I'm too weak even to stand. It's hopeless, right? Doesn't that kind of sound like the influence of the Witch King as well? Now, again, it's a perfectly logical thought. I'm not saying, you know, he has this otherwise totally inexplicable moment of despair. Like, his moment of despair is totally explicable. But again, in the context of the spiritual battle that's been going on, it seems significant, right, that he's having those kinds of thoughts. Domir Moria, what about that famous hobbit sturdiness? Yeah, well, I mean, he's still showing it. And again, we don't know exactly how long it would have taken. Again, all I'm saying is that chill down the side implies to me that the movement of the splinter, or at least the effect of the wound, was proceeding way faster than it looks like. You know, he's not on the, what is it in the end? 24 days, something like that. He's not on the 24-day trajectory, right, towards wraithification. If in a couple hours, the sense of its presence, right, the sense of its power is already working into his side, I don't like his odds. howsoever sturdy he is, I don't like his odds for lasting more than 17 days. That's right. 17 days. Very good. Yep. Yeah. Good. Good. Anyway, yeah. So he's not on the 17-day plan. It does not look like he's on a 17-day trajectory there when the chill is already spreading into his side in a couple hours. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Tony wonders if it wasn't influenced by Tolkien himself falling ill during the Somme and having to be evacuated. But he was evacuated with trench fever. He wasn't wounded. I mean, ironically, actually, it's much more like C.S. Lewis's experience. C.S. Lewis took shrapnel, which he carried in his body until he died. I'm pretty sure he still had some shrapnel in him through the rest of his life. So actually, in a sense, that, like, you know, being wounded and bearing the wounds and having to recover from the wounds and still having bits inside you is exactly what C.S. Lewis went through, whereas Tolkien's experience was different. He didn't receive a wound in that way. Anyway, certainly it doesn't have to be exactly analogous to be something that, you know, Tolkien would have had some experience with from his war experience. No question. Anyway, okay, let's see. A couple brief notes about, a couple brief notes about that last paragraph. The plans. Strider now says, "I think now that the enemy has been watching this place for some days." So in retrospect, the choice to come here probably wasn't that good after all. Remember, this is one of the choices that he was debating, right? Do we go? Do I discover the truth? Do I figure out what those flashes in the night were? Do I see if there's any sign of Gandalf or if those flashes in the night were Gandalf? I think that I personally, in that sentence, detect at least a little shade of bitterness directed at himself by Strider there. "I think now that the enemy has been watching this place for some days," doesn't explicitly add, "and therefore I was a numbskull for bringing us here," but I do think that's kind of the implied subtext of the observation that that Strider is making there. If Gandalf ever came here, then he must have been forced to ride away, and he will not return. So, and again, there too, if Gandalf ever came here, now they have uncovered evidence that at least suggests that Gandalf was in fact there, and Strider himself has already said that he himself believes that Gandalf was there. So once again, if Gandalf ever came here, there too, I think that he has, I think that he is being harsh on himself, right? Not, I think, seriously questioning his earlier interpretation. Right. Well, now I am second guessing my reading of the signs up on the top of the on top of the hill. Right. I don't think that he's really saying that. Again, this just sounds to me like he's angry at himself and being like, you know, essentially saying it doesn't matter if Gandalf came or not. Right. I mean, yes, I wanted to come here because I wanted to see if Gandalf was here, if that was Gandalf, if he lived or died. I wanted to know what happened. And now he's like, it doesn't matter. Right. It's completely immaterial. It was not worth it. Fool of a Strider, Brunier. Exactly. Tony, he does seem to be implying that he thinks the Nazgul had the he had the hill staked out since their encounter with Gandalf. Yeah, that's what he means when they've been watching this place for some days. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I Croucher, I think that there might be a kind of unspoken hope that Gandalf drives some of them away. Again, I think that there's that implication earlier on when he's like, why they weren't all here, I'm not sure. But yeah, the main point is, I now think it was foolish of us to come here, and there is certainly no good in staying. We are in great peril here after dark since the attack of last night, and we can hardly meet greater danger wherever we go. So, and again, that last statement, we can hardly meet greater danger wherever we go. I mean, again, it's a little hard for me not to read that as Aragorn essentially saying, well, here's the good news. The good news is I can't possibly screw it up any worse than I already have, right? So I've led you into a trap by your most deadly enemies. I might lead you into other difficulties in the future, but the good news is they're guaranteed to be less deadly than the trap I already led you into, right? So let's look at the bright side, people. The word that jumps out at me most in that last sentence is here. In any case, if he had just said, in any case, we are in great peril after dark since the attack of last night, I'd have been like, yeah, wherever you go after dark, you're going to be in trouble, right? Because they can sniff their way after you. They're going to be able to track you. So, and they, you know, they're more powerful at night. So, you know, if, sure, but that's not what he says, right? Or rather, he adds, we are in great peril here after dark since the attack of last night. And I'm not 100% sure how to read that. Again, I my inclination is to say that that word here is significant, that if they were to remain there, if they were not to go on, it would in some sense give the Ringwraiths more power over them. I cannot imagine that what he means is like, well, they know we're here, so if we stay here, they'll attack us again. Whereas if we keep walking, we might be able to shake them. Like, I don't think he's saying we might be able to shake them exactly. They probably could find them. Yeah, exactly. Tarlonio suggests the Nazgul have established some kind of spiritual foothold on that place. Yeah. The Del totally has bad vibes now. Absolutely. They're going to be more afraid in this place. I think they need to get moving for their, because in order to be, if they are going to be in a place, a mental, emotional, and spiritual place to be able to oppose the Nazgul, and that's what it's mostly about. It's not about swashbuckling, right? It's not about your torch-throwing skills. It's about where you are in your spiritual state, right, if you're going to oppose the Nazgul. And staying here, where they were already attacked once, and where they're going to be like, as soon as it gets, they're going to be looking at every rock on the hillside, saying, is that really a rock, right? So yeah, let's move. Let's keep moving. And yes, Evil Dr. Cannon, I agree. Moving would also be an act of resistance, whereas staying is giving up. Yeah, if they're like, well, we're never going to get to Rivendell, we might as well just try to ford up here and hope somebody comes to rescue us, right? But probably nobody will. Yeah, I would think that would be a bad move, right? Whereas again, like, it looks bad, I know, but let us forge on. Let us make it to Rivendell. Let's keep our hopes up. That seems much more effective. Puts them in a much stronger place. Yeah, and Tony, I agree. Even from the pure, most pragmatic possible standpoint, they're not in more danger moving than they are. I guess what he says, right? We can hardly meet greater danger wherever we go, right? So they will be at least as safe moving as staying there, and it can only be safer than staying. Boomful, you're right. Meaning all nine riders would have been worse. But in Gloomy Strider's defense, that wasn't an option, right? He led them into the worst possible danger that was available to them, right? It's not that we can't imagine greater dangers theoretically, right? But he did, in fact, manage to find a trap set by the greatest possible danger that was available to them. Yeah. And Brandon, you're right. There is a lot of PTSD stuff going on here, right? We saw Strider's PTSD. Frodo's definitely going to have it. We know he's going to have it, right? And Strider doesn't want all three of the other hobbits to develop it. Yeah. They're all going to be getting the cold shakes when night comes around in this dell again. Unlikely to become a popular camping spot with them in the future, no matter what happens. As soon as the daylight was full, they had some hurried food and packed. It was impossible for Frodo to walk, so they divided the greater part of their baggage among the four of them and put Frodo on the pony. In the last few days, the poor beast had improved wonderfully. It already seemed fatter and stronger, and had begun to show an affection for its new masters, especially for Sam. Bill Ferney's treatment must have been very hard for the journey in the wild to seem so much better than its former life. They started off in a southerly direction. This would mean crossing the road, but it was the quickest way to more wooded country. And they needed fuel, for Strider said that Frodo must be kept warm, especially at night, while fire would be some protection for them all. It was also his plan to shorten their journey by cutting across another great loop of the road. East beyond Weathertop, it changed its course and took a wide bend northwards. Okay. Belongsmon, I wonder if it's something like residual black breath. Yeah, it is almost like that. The pony, right? Now, Ardent Crayon, you're totally right that we left the pony out of our reenactment. We totally did. I would like to think that had this attack been several months later, the presence of Bill the Pony would have been of spiritual assistance to Sam, at least, right? Would have helped to bolster Sam. Maybe. Doesn't seem like he's a major player. In fact, I kind of suspect he's sort of tied up off to the side and utterly irrelevant to the actual attack. Yeah, Tarlonio, I doubt he would have been able to, you know, unleash the flying hooves of terror and, you know, clipped the Witch King in the shoulder on the way past or something. But anyway, Karita, he does get a beautiful story arc. Bill the Pony does. Yeah, totally agree. Bill would have gotten overshadowed by the fire anyway. It went in the recreation. Yeah, definitely. I just love this little detail that we get, right? Remember, it was Bill was called a thin, half-starved creature back in Bree when he was introduced. Clearly, he was sort of kept penned up and not fed over well by Bill Ferney. So just being able to wander and therefore presumably to graze some on his own would improve, doubtless has improved his diet, right, since the time when he was with Bill Ferney. His affection for his new masters seems to be as important as his getting fatter and stronger, right? Even just the way this sort of sense of the positive impact on Bill. And of course, I can't. It's Mad Violinist. I was just going to make a serious point about that. We do have the direct correspondence, right, between Frodo's ill-advised and possibly slightly nervous joke about him becoming a wraith if the thinning process doesn't go on indefinitely, right? There's much less of Frodo, but there's much more of Bill. Mad Violinist thinks that's a little suspicious, right? However, I find that parallel actually kind of interesting. Right. Frodo, of course, is getting healthier, too. What's that crack that Pippin makes when they set out? Right. You won't feel the weight so much when you've walked off some of your own. Right. So, you know, the thinning process for Frodo. Remember, it's how it starts. Right. With Merry saying you look twice the hobbit, you know, that you did. you know, and that's what leads Frodo to say, you know, it's odd considering there's actually a great deal less of me, right? So on the one hand, you can see both Frodo and Bill are rounding into shape, right? They are being improved by the exercise and things, though moving in opposite directions. But I think there's more to it than that. And again, it's to me an interesting parallel. Frodo makes a joke that would seem, based on the reading that we did several weeks back, it would seem to kind of betray some anxiety in Frodo, right? That becoming a Wraith is rather on his mind, and that perhaps, you know, his joke seems to suggest that he views becoming a Wraith as at least a plausible, if not a likely, end point for his career and his adventure, right? What we see with Bill Ferney, or not Bill Ferney, with Bill the Pony, right? Bill Ferney's pony, is exactly the opposite, right? As he is under the influence and surrounded by the... I think it's clear that he is showing affection for his new masters because he is receiving affection from his new masters, right? The effect is, you know, again, spiritually, it's a little weird to think about the spiritual state of the pony. But again, seeing him, he's moving in a positive direction, right? Frodo is worrying that he is going to thin and thin until he becomes a Wraith, right? Bill the Pony is, de-wraithify, right? He's moving distinctly in the opposite direction, becoming more and more solid, and more fat, which is in this case a very good sign. Exactly, JJ, especially since the paragon of pony health and happiness that we know of is Fatty Lumpkin. Right. Clearly, Fatty Lumpkin is both the most happy and healthy pony of anyone that we know. Right. Clearly, there is no pony who beats Fatty Lumpkin in, you know, life and job satisfaction. So clearly, this is a move in the right direction. OK. Interesting business about the fire here. We see. You know, this, of course, it's sort of nothing new exactly. Certainly the business about its being protection for them all. I think we understand where we're coming from here with that. The interesting thing to me is about Frodo being kept warm. That, of course, is entirely practical, but I think it's more than just practical as well. Remember, the influence of the wound on Frodo was perceived as a chill, right? It was perceived as a chill. So he, in fighting it with fire, he's not just being pragmatic here, right? Whatever kind of spiritual presence or influence fire has, and it seems to have some, right? The writers don't love it. It seems to have some kind of an effect on the wound, or at least Strider believes that it will. So whatever it is in fire that... Now, repels might be too strong a word, but discomfits Black Riders, right? Will hopefully, he seems to be hoping, help also to slow the progression of the wound as well. Cool. Hey, Sympatine, welcome to Twitch. Glad you could join us live here. Okay. And then, of course, Boomful, as I think you were pointing out before, he's doing a shortcut, right? And notice nobody complains, right? Pippin made a crack about it before. No one doubts Strider here now, right? Of course, he's going to shorten their journey by cutting across a great loop of the road, right? Like you do when you're Strider. His cuts, short or long, don't go wrong. Which is interesting in the context of his lack of confidence in himself just a slide ago, right? And all of those what sounds pretty bitter things he was saying against himself and his own decisions. Well, I won't say saying against. The cutting edge that they seemed to have, that seemed to bear on himself and on the decisions that he made. But yet he is still moving forward. He's not doubting himself. He might be chiding himself for the decision that he did make, but that's not going to stop him from moving forward. Yeah. Okay. That was pretty good. How many slides did we do tonight? Three? Wow. Three slides. That was intense. Right? I should probably stop there, though. So we can actually have a field trip at a reasonable time tonight, and I can end like by midnight or something, which I've been getting pretty sloppy about doing. Okay. So we're gonna stop the book portion of our discussion here tonight, and we're gonna switch over to our field trip, right? So we're gonna do our field trip. So I'm going to say goodbye to the folks on Twitter. Thanks, you guys. We're great contributions again tonight. Good to have an increasingly steady audience on the Twitter side. That's been a lot of fun. Live Twitter audience. I know that there have been people who have been watching asynchronously too. But anyway, so thanks everybody for joining us on Twitter. I'm going to say goodbye to those folks. We're switching over. You can join us on twitch.tv/signumu. So bye, Twitter people. Okay.
Good evening, everyone.
All right. Good evening. All right. So we're headed back to Gartha Garwin tonight because we didn't get to finish it.
We were having a fun time climbing on all the walls and stuff.
Yes.
And looking at the new map.
Yep. Oh, yeah, the new map. So. Yeah, that was like half the segment last time.
Yeah, it was.
I was totally ambushed by that map.
Middle Earth from space. I was thinking it over. So it was like Obsidian. Was it Obsidian Stiletto?
And Evil Payload.
Evil Payload. Yeah, Evil Payload sounds like the garage band grunge people. And then Obsidian Stiletto sounds like sort of wannabe new wave band or something like that. I get a feeling they'd be doing covers of each other at some point.
It's possible. Oh, okay. Hey, I was lagging and found myself accidentally pointed in the correct direction.
Oh, wow.
That's unusual.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people roller skating and flying broomsticks around the town.
Ah. Is it Harvest Festival again?
They will be launching that after the patch tomorrow. I think after they wanted to debug everything first, and then the Harvest Myth will be up with the new patch, which is going to happen between 8 and 12 tomorrow.
Okay.
So I don't always want to play Lotro in the morning, but when I do, it's a server patch.
Right.
That's the way of it, though. Well, I'm actually glad they're doing a Wednesday today instead of a Tuesday. Tuesday, I'm always like, oh, I have to get on and get ready for everything Wednesday, and I've usually been doing this until midnight, so I don't mind sleeping in.
Right.
All right.
Okay, so is this where the glitch is happening?
I don't know if it's happening for everyone. It's actually not happening for me, for Oscareth.
Okay, let's see.
So they might have had a hot patch for that. But yes, if you're looking at the Stable Master and you know you have a swift travel for Oscareth and it's not working, try dismounting first. Right. It should clear it up. This was a bug that was happening earlier this week, but they might have done a hot patch to at least fix this before they go into the big thing tomorrow.
Okay.
So we're talking about like Frodo and the shard getting towards his heart and stuff like that.
Sorry. Yep.
And my head just kept going back to Iron Man, actually.
The Iron Man? Yeah. There were a couple of people who were making Iron Man reference with the shrapnel.
Yeah, with the arc reactor. Because that was, you know, not only a physical detriment, but it was also became a spiritual one as he became a better person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I thought it was interesting how they, I thought it was interesting how they play, at least, you know, sort of the connection to his own sort of emotional state, right? And his whole kind of attitude and outlook as well, and the way that they made that kind of, you know, connected with the shrapnel. I thought it was interesting how that developed over, certainly over the three Iron Man movies.
Mm-hmm. But we're thinking after all, it's Jack's fault, huh?
Yeah, who knows?
Jack Lewis, I meant, folks, sorry.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I goodness knows that kind of experience, that is, that experience of taking shrapnel and having it lingering in your body is not something that was, I mean, that did happen to Lewis, but it's not like it was a rare or unusual experience.
Oh, yeah. No. That was
for people in the war. And of course, he didn't know Lewis until long after that. So. Long after the war, I mean, so,
Oh yeah, no, but you know, I'm sure it came up in inkling discussions.
Oh sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we went through the sort of outer segments of this. And again, one of the things that I want to look at here is that based on my thinking, and my sort of, our, you know, geographic and archaeological analysis here in the Lone Lands, it is my theory that Gartha Garwin here is the center, is the kind of primary locus of Rudaur. Like, this was the seed of Rudaur.
The hub of Rudaur.
That's my theory.
And it's a very elaborate palace.
It is. I mean, this place, so yeah, I wanted to go this way here today. We kind of came around through to this areas around here. Hang on, what's over here? Ooh.
It's Big Bad. It's supposed to be here. I think that's only in the Radagast instance.
Look at this guy, though.
Oh, yeah, look at that throne. Oh, man, that's like a green man.
Oh yeah, there's a lot. Wow, I don't need to dismount. So first of all, we have these kings, right?
Yeah.
Because see, look at this. This guy, he doesn't look sketchy at all. Right? I mean, this is a totally non-sketchy looking Rudaurin king. It's obviously Rudaur because it's got the forest crown below it,
And the scepter, I think. Isn't that the scepter? It's got an incredibly... Well, it's weird. It's like scepter on one side and a sword on the other, or it's a sword with spiky bits on the bottom, which is very, very impractical.
Yeah, not quite sure about what he's holding. What I'm looking at here, though, are his sleeves. And I think those are trees on the sleeves.
Pretty.
Which is very pretty. Very different. Like, very lovely.
It's like a kimono pattern.
Yeah, it's very bucolic, right? I mean, this is... And he looks like a nice chap. Let me see if I can...
Yeah, this is the good PR statue.
Yeah.
This is the whole, don't let them know that we're the evil king of evil.
Well, see, that's the point, is I don't think this guy was an evil king of evil yet.
Yet.
I mean, he might never have become so.
Yeah, look at this Joker.
Okay, see, now this guy... has a few more issues. Now, why is he double-fisting Palantir?
Two Palantirs. He's going to get feedback.
I mean, that's fairly remarkable. Now, I mean, we know, of course, there were multiple Palantiri. I mean, there were, what, three in the Northern Kingdoms, though two of them that were primarily used, right? Because there was the third that was out on the coast... which is really just oriented to, like, look off towards Numenor and Tolaresia. Whereas there were both of the Palantiri that Arvedui had with him, right, that went down in the Bay of Forakel, the one from Numenus and the one from Amon Sul. It's a conference call, belongs Monteth.
You could just see that with the Palantiri. Okay, I still can't hear you.
Right.
Dog barking in the background.
Right.
Let's start and introduce ourselves. But it's like, is it wishful thinking or is it just a bid for symmetry?
Well, I think the symmetry can't hurt, although the rest of it isn't symmetrical.
Look at his beard. It's like his beard is like threaded around him.
Yeah. His crown. Look at the difference between his crown here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the crown of that other guy over here.
The good PR statue.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's tasteful and kind of subtle and
not spiky. Not iron crown-like.
Yes, it's benevolent forest king's crown.
And I agree. I think it is a scepter, not a sword, that he's holding. Its bottom is kind of pointy, but I'm not seeing really a hilt. I mean, that you could say that that's just like a square pommel that's sticking out above his hands, but there doesn't seem to be any crosspiece. And
it could just be dissolving into the
really short.
Could just be dissolving into the front piece, like, you know, how he has no legs and stuff.
Right. Well, it's possible. But I don't think so. I think it's a scepter, especially given the whole scepter thing. Right? It's clearly
I agree it's a scepter, but I think the foot might not be pointy. I think it's just dissolving tastefully into...
Oh, I see. The foot. Got it. Yes. Okay. No, I agree. So here's my theory here, though. Here's the point that I would come back to. What I find so fascinating about these statues here. Rudaur is not evil from day one. Rudaur falls. But so, I mean, like, okay, so claiming the throne, you know, that's not great, but presumably they had some claim, right? I mean, the disagreements between, you know, Arthedain and Cardolan and Rudaur could very well have been honest disagreements at first, right?
You know, they did all share the same bloodline in theory,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah, they did. They did. And although it does seem that the people of... I mean, the fact that Aragorn is descended from the kings of Arthedain and the fact that, you know, Aragorn is spoken of as being, you know, descended in unbroken lineage from Isildur does suggest that, you know, the kings of Arthedain have a more direct line. But, you know, we know how, I mean, you know, like the Wars of the Roses happened, right? You know, both of them have claims. And you can say that one is better than another, but it's not like it's a slam dunk that the House of Lancaster's claim to the throne is a better claim than the House of York. I mean, they're both a little bit on the flimsy side.
Yeah, it's like we're at this point, we're looking at second cousins all around.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, the point is, I think that it's important for us not to think that Rudaur is just like the evil empire from day one, right? It's part of the tragedy of the Arnorian civil wars that things collapse to that extent. And Rudaur's tragedy is particularly strong because they fall furthest from faction of the Dunedain who felt they had a rightful claim to the throne that was being denied, and then they made the choice to splinter off, which is never a good move, right? And now they're at war with their companions and, you know, with their relatives, with the other Arnorian kingdoms. And in order to win that war, they ally themselves with Angmar.
It's almost the second fall of Numenor in that way.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It does kind of mirror in some ways the fall of Numenor. Now, it's not that the sequence of events exactly mirrors it. But again, that like desire to draw on some, on, you know, a forbidden power in order to achieve your end, or even perhaps by that stage in the Arnorian civil wars to achieve vengeance, you know, for the wrongs they felt they had suffered and that kind of thing.
By aligning themselves with a charismatic nut job bad guy.
Right. Just like Numenor. I definitely think that. So I'm wondering if we're not seeing some memory of that here, right? Like this king, you know, I wonder if this is, it makes me think of, you know, the passage that I'm just kind of acknowledging is in the back of my head, is that passage from The Magician's Nephew when Diggory and Polly come into the Hall of Images, right? With all the kings and queens of Charn, and the first kings and queens of Charn are look beautiful and happy. And then as it proceed, they like continue to look beautiful, but no longer happy. Right. And then they, you know, until at the end, you've got, of course, Jadis at the end who looks evil and terrible, but devastatingly beautiful. Basically that's kind of what I'm imagining in a sense as happening, in Rudaur, and some archaeological evidence of that here. That we are seeing here, would be my theory, a legitimately benevolent Rudaurin king, right? Like, this could be the guy, this could be the dude who thought, you know, honestly thought he should have made a bad choice, right, to splinter off, but he legitimately thought he should be king, right, and was trying to be a good ruler and had what he felt were good reasons, you know, to break off from the rest and to oppose Arthedain, and doubtless would have considered the civil war, you know, the war of Arthedainian aggression and all that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
And then you progress, right? Then you, next thing you know, you're looking like this guy, right? Who's like, I have all the Palantiri and like my crown is now derivative of the Iron Crown, of Angmar, right?
Yeah.
And
he copied my style.
Right. Exactly. So I definitely, this would sort of fit with my theory that this place is the heart of Rudaurin power, and that here in this place we can see, oh, look, again, we get the star superimposed on the crown, or the crown superimposed upon the star above the scepter there.
Oh, yeah.
Just like in that, the bath outside near the stable master at Oscaroo.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the only other place I've ever seen that. At least that I noticed. Anyway, so that's pretty cool. I'd totally forgotten that this crown was here. I remember that this was the place where the big mob always spawns that you have to do the quest for. But
that's a gaunt man who's here, though, right?
Something like that. Yeah.
Reigns of the Soldier.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a ghost of the Soldier.
I can't remember. Was he just a big white, or was he a gaunt man? He might have been a gaunt man.
Been too long.
Yeah. I don't remember. But anyway, yeah, no, that's really cool. That's really cool. And remember the fancy portcullises? There's another one that we just wrote underneath, right?
Yeah.
Again, like the sense of the sense of like this, like archaeological evidence of like an older, nicer Rudaur before things really went bad.
Yeah, because it's a portcullis that's more ornamental than functional, given
how
delicate and lacy it is.
Yeah, exactly. Whoa. Okay, I'm looking at walls, crowns all over. Not too much else. This wall always struck me as a little strange. I guess this is just a building. Okay, and we have flagstones, but what was this? Blank walls, no windows. I might have expected
see, the tiles keep going.
Here, it keeps going?
The tiles, well, it is. It sort of fades out.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No idea what this was. And there's more over here. There's just a bunch of random buildings. See, exactly. Something like this now.
That's a gazebo.
Yeah, exactly. I would have expected a gazebo back here, obviously.
But let me get the tree that's creeping up on us.
Oh, yeah.
You know you're absorbed in archaeological exploration when a tree sneaks up on you.
That happens more times than I'd care to say.
It's so true. Okay. Sorry, I was looking.
This is one of the old archways. You notice the stone on this one isn't the new pink concrete.
Yeah. Does this suggest that... Are we seeing different... Because this is a fortification. I mean, look how thick those walls are. Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
That is massive. This is not like an interior wall here. This is not just like a partition. And this arch, right? Uh-huh. I mean, we don't see any portcullis or any gates in here, but... I mean, this is like twice as thick as my horse's long.
Yeah. Well, this one, you'd almost expect like a big iron, you know, gate and giant
absolutely.
Plank door kind of deal. It's probably buried under the mud now.
Absolutely. Which leads me therefore to a theory. And the theory is that, again, if this is the original sort of home and center of the people of Rudauer, then... What are these guys? Grim White.
Yeah, got some dark waters out here, too. It's really good for the deed if you need them.
I see, yeah. Okay, so the theory is that what we're seeing in here... Because, again, like walls like those that one we were just looking at, these are not the kinds of walls that you would have inside. And we're deep inside the fortifications, right? And you think about... Even if you think of the outer boundary... of the defenses here in Garth of Garwen as being the pass that we come through from the blood circle. And the places just inside there. We're way inside that. We're like three defensive layers in from that. And yet we're seeing these what look like external fortifications. Nevertheless, which leads me to wonder if we're not seeing multiple like historical layers added on, right? Like the original family of Rudauer had these keeps here, right? Deep inside this valley. And then as the civil war escalated, they then sort of built outwards new layers of defenses. That's my theory. Because this is huge.
These are almost built like canals, too, with all the bridges. You'd think this area had water in it before.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really good point. Oh, look, gazebo with headless statue. And artichokes.
Yay!
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of the ruins in the Harloweg, really. I mean, of course, the standing water helps with that association, but...
Yeah, it sure does. But it's a labyrinth.
Yes, it's huge. Oh, I this is a boss up here, too, isn't there?
Yeah, let me... I'm trying to help out some lowlies here. So.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. Soon have it done. We're all working together.
Okay. And then I just want to see if this guy has a throne or anything interesting. No, look at the... What is this? A slab? An altar slab?
Let's see. Oh, yeah. This is the part that looks like barrow downs.
Yeah, well, this is obviously later construction, right? Look how this slab has been erected... up right in front of those of the kings.
It's still got the Rudauer thing on the side.
It does have the Rudauer thing on the side. Do you think that the whites could have taken stones like which already, you know, had the Rudauer stamp on them already from elsewhere in the ruins and built these
recycled it
to make a kind of altar here? Because I mean this looks like a crude altar, right?
It not looks like cool, a different kind of stone, too, almost like a rose kind of marble.
Yeah. Yeah, like it might be transported from elsewhere. How many? Oh, there are five. This is the five kings.
Yes.
I said I was counting
kings. Oh, that's, yeah, they're all in a row this time. You don't have that one big one in the middle.
Yes, exactly. Trying to see. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Wonder if those five, yeah, it's, once again, it's like the five kings. It's always five in the Rudar stuff. Like, you wonder if that was how many generations back you can trace the true line.
Yeah, maybe. I wonder. Could this be a tomb? You mean the thing I'm standing on, Bricktails?
So, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather, possibly.
Right.
Was the common ancestor. Progenitor.
Right. Yeah, this thing that I'm calling an altar. It is possible.
But, yeah, looks like an altar.
It does look, especially, see, look, like right over here is the what you were talking about with the five kings with the big one in the middle.
Oh, yeah, that one there.
Right, this is the normal one.
One of the kings is covered up.
Yeah, they built over the other king. That's weird.
Yeah.
Who bricked that up
definitely
the
me.
Fifth king?
Bricked up the last king. It's definitely one of those. This altar is more important.
Yeah.
Yeah, old masonry, new masonry.
Yeah, maybe again that reflects a generational corruption, right?
Yep.
Like they had the old building here, and then they were like, no, we need to erect a...
Temple.
Temple,
yeah. To Sauron.
Right, and it was done by the Rudaurans, so they used the Rudauran, you know, they put the Rudauran marks on the stone. Now, it doesn't look... This is a pretty tame altar, right?
Yeah, it's kind of boring. It's functional.
Yeah, it's very tame. It doesn't have, like, we don't get the you know, the sort of icon of Sauron that we've seen in other places. We don't get the, like in Faramost, we saw it all over the place with all the swords, right, and all the things, all the eyes. We didn't get like, you know, the there's no white factory chimney here, you know, with multicolored smoke. We don't get even like a little goblin shrine thing. Right.
Yeah, no, you can tell they're deluding themselves into thinking this isn't evil at all, is it?
Right.
No.
That is kind of what it looks like, right? This is anywhere. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Minimalist, restrained evil.
Just the two tasteful iron braziers, right?
Yes.
Right.
Nothing evil. Nothing at all. Quite ordinary box. Yeah. Now, you think there's anyone in there? Is that a tomb?
I don't think it is a tomb. I don't think it could. I mean, I can't absolutely rule it out, but the primary reason I don't think it's a tomb, here's the stairs, is that, you know, there are tombs right here that look like this, right? And these are like standard Arnorian tombs, right? We see these.
Yeah, but there aren't any altars near those.
Right. Well, my point is just, I mean, this is how they do tombs, right?
Yes.
And we don't have any precedent for a tomb that looks like that. I mean,
we do in Angmar. We do in Angmar. There's stuff that looks like this in Angmar. There's a lot of these little bare sort of phylactery-looking boxes up there.
Hmm. Well, we'll come back. We'll get back to Angmar someday, and when we do, we'll look into that. We'll look into that.
Yeah.
If we could show that even archaeologically speaking, that was an Angmarim influence, that'd be pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I seem to think we were looking at big old stone boxes in Angmar that were pretty unadorned.
Yeah, maybe. We'll head back there at some point. But yeah, so okay, so if what we can see through, not just through here, like this particular section, but through this whole area, is sort of archaeological evidence of the decline and sort of moral decay of the Rudauran people.
Mm-hmm.
That would be interesting. Now, as I'm recalling, up here in this corner, we're getting... Ooh. What is that, a little keep? A little keep?
Oh, yeah. Tower? Big watchtower. It looks like the watchtowers we've seen.
Oh, but they've bricked it up.
No! Lame. But an anvil was left here for some reason.
Right. Because you never know when you might need an anvil.
Yeah.
You don't want to carry one with you, so... better.
Yeah, at some
around.
Point, somebody on their journey said, "Why am I lugging this anvil?"
That's right. Now, this up here in this corner, in this extreme corner, this is where the big old evil tree is, right?
Yeah. Like the proper evil tree.
Is he up here? Is this the way? Am I remembering correctly?
Yes, I think so, but I'm not sure.
Is he up in here? Is he further in?
I'm not sure if there's requirements to get in.
This is the guy. Gloomleaf, that's the guy I'm thinking of. I know there's another even eviler tree.
That's what it was. Yeah, there was an instance with an even eviler one.
Yeah, but this is the like junior evil tree.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, somebody one-shotted him.
Somebody one-shotted Gloomleaf?
Jeepers.
Yeah, okay. Gloomleaf, right. So, but see, okay, notice now thematically the things that we have going on here, right? Think about the... Mm-hmm. What are the primary mob types that we get here in Garth of Garwen?
Right? Bog lurkers? Like nature-y stuff.
Nature-y stuff.
Corrupted
nature. Right, exactly. The dark waters. So we get the dark waters, spirits of water that have
elemental.
Been corrupted. Right, yeah, exactly. We get the trees, right, who have been corrupted, including Gloomleaf, right, who has, like, gotten very sad over the years, and the sadness has worked its way into the core of his arboreal heart and
trees have hearts, man.
He's all malicious, absolutely. We have whites, right? So we have the
unquiet dead.
Exactly. So, in other words, you can see like the pattern is like, again, Rudaur as it once was and as it has been corrupted and perverted. You have the effect of the you have the literal effect of the unquiet dead, right, with the whites. You have the trees, which are the symbol of Rudaur, right? And you know, the forest, like this was the kingdom of the forest. That's what it means. And, you know, now we have all these twisted and dark trees. And then, of course, you have these guys, the fell bog prowlers, right? Again, spirits of nature. So you got the spirits of the forest and the spirits of the marshland, right? All of whom have been twisted and corrupted. And then, of course, the water itself, those bright red dark waters, which certainly reflect the bloody waters, which are not just about there. And this is why I find the Red Maid story so sort of poignant, is that it's not just about the corruption of Rudaur, right? But it's about the tragedy of the civil wars as a whole, right?
The corruption of the land itself.
Exactly. The people of Arthedain played a role in the corruption of the Red Maid. Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now
then
we
got
here,
these guys.
Right. Now we got the Kreoths, which of course makes sense because these are not. So what is their relationship here?
Well, we know they got new flags. We found that out last time.
Yes. Yes. These are a Kreoth novice and a Kreoth faithful, right? I think we get like captains or some such. No, novices and faithful still here. Okay.
Yeah, this is heightened ability bad guys, so be on your guard, everyone.
Right.
This is an area usually meant for fellowship, so stay together.
Who are these guys? Elders. Okay, so these guys are elders. Elders, novices, and faithful. So there is a sort of a sense of a cult identity, right, with these guys.
Yes.
They look like Hillman tribes.
But the name implies there's some sort of fighting for a cause zealots.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe Crusaders trying to take back their land or something?
Well, that's the question, right? So what is the link between the Kreoth and the Rudaurans of yore? There's the Gloomwater. Wretched Gloomwater. I love that.
Well, the link is Angmar, for sure.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that one was a novice, so we're still getting these clerical titles.
Right. I love how the Gloomwaters are wretched, right? They can't help it. It's not their, it's not malice, necessarily, right? It's wretchedness.
Going through a bad patch.
Yeah.
The economy these days. Now, yeah, there's the new shiny new flags here.
Right. And it's got the flag of Rudaur in color this time.
Yes. So maybe implying that these will be the heirs of Rudaur's kingdom.
Right. Are they the long lost heirs? Or are they just the new heirs?
Promised. Chosen heirs.
I think the implication is that they at least consider them, whether they are in truth or not, who knows, but I think the implication is that they consider themselves the heirs.
Given the ties of the thing where it's not unreasonable to think one tribe was maybe close friends with the Rudaurn and possibly intermarried.
Right, right, exactly. Yes.
Oh, hello, person selling things.
Yes. Oh, I think I remember this lady as being one of the vendors I was most happy to see, like, ever playing this game.
Still won't repair your weapons.
Yeah, that is annoying. But yes, I remember being so vexed having to, like, go all the way back out of here in order to...
Yeah, it's like you had to go all the way to Oscaroth in order to sell something. Yeah.
So, because the thing about the Kreoth that's interesting, sort of historically speaking, right? Okay, now we're entering Garth Agarwin proper.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the banners all over the place. Oh, man, those guys killed me so hard the first time I came here.
Yeah, I was not prepared the first time I came.
Yeah, no, me neither. They absolutely leveled me. Goodness, these banners are everywhere. Right, so again, the important thing historically to remember is that the Hillmen and the Rudaurans are not identical, right? You've got the two very different races. The one Numenoreans, right? Okay, now we've got leaders and disciples still with the cult titles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Still with the cult titles. Another leader. A warden. That's interesting. I have failed you.
I have failed you, Red Nate. Oh, that's who they're worshipping.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, now we see the heart of the cult, right? Is that they're worshipping the Red Maid herself. Oh, that's really cool.
Oh, so that's what the red waves on the banner indicates.
Ah, yes. So it's the crown of Rudaur set emphatically within the context of the red water of Garth Agarwin.
Yep.
And therefore the influence of the Red Maid. Oh, that's really cool. That's really cool. I like
Look,
that.
Look, a new Rudaur sculpture. Newish.
Oh, yeah, it's another one of those imported dude with Palantir.
Look how cool
sword.
I am, statue. Yeah,
see, this looks like a step further down the moral evolution, right, of the Kings of Rudaur.
Yeah,
now
not
he's
quite
holding
evil,
the sword
certainly...
and he's holding the sword up, right, like he's threatening with it, not just posing with it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so... So you have the Rudaurans, who are the Numenoreans, and then you have the Hillmen. Now, the Hillmen, remember, we were looking at this when we were in Angmar. We can see that the Hillmen had their own independent culture, but that they were, like, then sort of taken over, dominated by Angmar.
Yes.
You know, and have been enslaved by Angmar, and we saw, you know, ways in which the when we were looking at the different archaeological layers apparent in Angmar, seeing the ways, the kind of complicated relationship back and forth with the fall and rise of Angmar between the Hillman culture and the Angmarim culture. Here in Rudaur, of course, we have three things intermingling, therefore, right? You've got the Arnorian tradition of Rudaur, with all the crowns and all the stars still that we can see, and scepters. And then we have the Hillman, then we have the Angmarim culture, right? You've got the Witch King, direct influence of the Witch King, and the sort of the dark power of Angmar that is being appealed to by the Rudaurans in order to assist their cause, right? And then you've got the Hillman in the middle, who are allies, but also, you know, this is also the Numenoreans joining themselves with lesser men as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kreoth would seem to be the heirs, possibly, of those two. I mean, the possibility of intermingling, of like intermarriage among them, seems to be possible. And the Kreoth being the sort of the result of that combination. Their cult-like nature and the extent to which they seem to worship the Red Maid herself, though.
Yep.
I don't think I ever really processed that before, because that is super cool.
Me neither.
If we see the Red Maid as, in a sense, the effect of the war, right? She's the effect of the war between Rudaur and Arthedain and Cardolan.
Mm-hmm.
And that the heirs, or the people who are at least claiming to be the heirs of Rudaur and returning to this land, which again, my theory, is the original seat of Rudaur, if they are worshipping the Red Maid, it's a really lovely sort of, in the later days, people not getting it, right? You know, she is, not only are they not like repenting of the sins of their fathers, they are worshiping the product of the sins of their fathers. You know, they are holding, instead of working to free her, she is herself wretched, right? Like the gloom waters were, she is herself suffering, and the redness and her malice is a product of her own suffering and her own torture. And instead of wanting to alleviate that torture, they worship her for the power that is derived from that, right? From, they worship her in her tormented state. And that's really interesting.
Parallel for our times, I suppose.
But anyway, I think that seems to me like a really insightful picture into the kinds of things that Tolkien describes with the decline, right? The decline of peoples over the years, and sort of how they go bad and what it looks like when they go bad, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And kind of diminish over time.
It still begs the question, are they actually related to Rudaur, or is the Red Maid being, unofficially queen of this entire area, she sort of granting them the land as her faithful servants.
Right, exactly. Like, you can...
Well, the faithful will inherit my lands, sort of thing.
Yeah, you're like the can we get devout and disciples and leaders. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The kind of de facto, we are the heirs of Rudaur because they used to live here and now we do, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think their claim is more than that.
Yeah, considering they're using Rudarth's crest.
So. Yes, exactly. Yeah, the actual crest there.
Rudaurth, the Red Lake, Red Despot.
Now, I got lost here so many times, and I only have a general sense that I'm going in a right direction, but I don't know that I really am.
What are we looking for? That might help.
I don't even know.
Are we trying to get out, or are we trying to go further into
this?
We're
trying to go in.
I don't know.
I want to find the
The center. Hang on. It's in here.
Well, there was an instance further in, but
yes, this is what I was looking for. This is what I was looking for. I think I went all the way around and came in the back door. But this is what I wanted to see.
Guns up, people. There we go.
Okay, because we got chieftains and wardens, and then we have Temire the Devoted, who also just got one-shotted. But she is the leader of the Kree.
Dime's on Kriya, fire right? tonight.
Is that Dime one-shotting things?
It's Dime.
Dime the oops, I accidentally killed the Balrog one-shotting things? Yeah, that's good.
Oops, I killed it again.
That's awesome. I should have known.
Yeah, so see, here's the nice kings surrounded by corpses.
Exactly. And is it just the one of them? No, there's two. There's three. We got three of the nice kings. So this place, right? I mean, there's every...
We've lost all pretense of this being a respectable worship at this point.
Yeah. It's got... Notice the central dais here is just the star of Arnor. We don't even have any of the
trappings.
None of the crowns. None of the crowns are in the lower level.
No artichoke. Well, yeah, that has the artichoke as well. But yeah, it's just a cool 7-point star. Like that in itself is some sort of divine power.
Right, like focusing on the Numenorean roots rather than just sort of shouting Rudaur all the time, like so much of the rest of the architecture.
Weird pointy metal that comes from a foreign place over here.
Wait, where? Where's the pointy
metal? For the crow's cage.
Yes.
Where have we seen those little...
the bars that was making up the... Yeah, oh, that's Angmarim straight up.
Yeah.
Just like the fish hooks back in Angmar.
Yeah, it looks exactly...
Totally.
The metal's not quite as purple, but...
Yeah, no, it's a dead giveaway. Yeah, no. I mean, obviously, like, you'd think that the cages with the desiccated corpses in them are kind of a giveaway that it's an Angmarim influence anyhow, but yeah, no, that really seals it.
It's not even... Oh, are the bodies being laid at different points of the star? Or is that just a coincidence?
I don't think they're...
Some of them are. Them. 1, 2, 3.
They're all bring out to the right wagon. Of the king statues.
Yes.
Like just to the right of it. Almost as if...
Yeah, this guy breaks up the pattern. Otherwise, there's one at each... Because
there are three, right?
Yeah, I don't know. No, there's a skeleton, guy, skeleton.
Right, no, there's three skeletons and three statues.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that's what I'm seeing. It's almost like we've got the three benevolent kings, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the three skeleton cages, right?
Yep.
Which have been set in the same pattern as the king statues. So it's almost it seems to me slightly like sort of shades of the crossroads in Ithilien, right? Like we're gonna take your benevolent king statues and we're gonna put a like torture cages, right, like seated at the right hand of all three of those benevolent kings. They are seated at the right hand of the kings of the old kings of Rudaur.
You wonder who they were.
Yeah. Yeah, and then of course they have the white factory, which is the one other thing which kind of disrupts the whole pattern. And notice they've put that white factory at the end of the long point of the star.
Yes.
Right. As if the star of the Valar is pointing now, as if the light of the Silmaril from Eärendil's ship is pointing down at the white factory.
Presumptuous.
Yeah, which is, not a very wholesome look, certainly.
What about this never-ending fire in the middle here?
Yeah, well,
I don't know what to make of the never-ending fire, honestly.
Oh, it's not doing any damage. It's just sort of there. Huh.
Having just participated in the Mythgard Movie Club discussion of Rider Haggard's She, that's kind of what it makes me think of, the flame of eternal life that wells up within the volcano in She, but slightly obscure reference. Erokeb points out that they could possibly have found the flame imperishable, but I rather doubt that. Now, look at this portcullis. Would you see? Now, this is what you more expect to see in a portcullis, right?
That's a proper portcullis.
Right. A non-decorative, rather clumsy, somewhat askew portcullis.
It looks like it's gotten the job done a few times.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's actually withstood assault. Okay. this is the main political instance, right? Not the one with Ivar the Bloodhand, and there's the one with Ivar the Bloodhand. There's the one
with the Red Maid herself.
With the Red Maid herself.
There's and the one with the one tree. With the tree, yeah. And one with just basically sacking the Hillman, I think, isn't it?
And that's what this one is, right?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I think so. All right. I'm going to go in. I'll be just... the ruins of an ancient fortress of Rudaur now overrun by corrupted nature and a vile necromantic power out of Angmar. Or is it... Oh, this is the Red Maid one?
Yeah, okay. This is proper Red Maid. Might want to form a team for that one.
Well, maybe I can just explore. I mean, you guys are welcome to form a team. So, hang on a second. Where's the instance finder? What's the keyboard command for the default keyboard command for the instance finder?
Oh, I just plugged it in. Should be on your main dashboard. It's three people and a ghost behind them. And the little icon.
Right. That's the social. Aha! Oh yeah, that one. Okay, right.
Don't look at me to save your bacon tonight, Professor. I don't have a tune on Gladden to help.
No worries. Not a problem.
But Lori's got you.
Besides, I'm like, what, 30, 60 levels over? I can probably...
You will want to scale it down?
I want to scale it down?
I think it's set at 32. I think it's set at 32.
Well, yeah, I'll scale it down. Okay, hang on a second.
Why don't you fellow with me, though?
These are non-scaling. These don't scale.
Yeah.
It's the artery. So it's the fortress. The fortress is the one I'm looking for, right?
Yeah, this one is called what? Yeah, fortress.
Yeah, it's non-scaling.
Wait, this one here is called fortress?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's just going
I'm just trying to...
I'm just going to go to that one. At level 32. Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Do people want to form a six man? I mean, we're going to be massively overpowered for a six man. I was just going to kind of cruise through it and ignore most everybody. I'm just going to look at architecture.
All right.
I don't really need to fight the Red Maid and finish the instance.
Garth the Garwin.
I just want to look around.
The ruins of an ancient fortress of Rudaur, now overrun by corrupted nature and a vile necromantic power out of Angmar. Okay. The most terrible power still remains to be confronted.
Okay, so right, we're keeping it up.
I guess.
I don't really want to fight people. Yeah, you're going to kill me.
Yeah, they're going to rush at you anyway.
Okay, well, I was kind of hoping they'd ignore me. I just wanted to test that.
Not in an instance.
Not in an instance. Oh, well. Well.
This might take a while anyway, just from the sheer volume of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a test. Well, see, here's where I want to, I wish I could just stealth and go through.
You're not a burglar this time.
I know.
We're on Landreval next week. I mean, that's ideal.
Let's try to just go come back with Grifflet and go through here.
Yeah, totally.
No, I don't want to. Even if I could make it, and I'm
I have no equipment of any kind. So, yeah. I'm not really prepared to actually fight my way through an instance. I just mostly wanted to look around anyway. Well, maybe, maybe we can, it's getting late.
The other things with the six man, you'd at least kill everybody faster and be able to get to look at things faster.
Exactly. So maybe next week we'll form up a super overpowered six man and just like power run. Cause I'd like to do this one.
Yeah.
Cause this is the
Gravity
core.
Has an idea.
Yeah.
He says you need someone to finish the instance before you and then invite you in for a tour when it's empty.
Oh, that's cunning, Gravity. That's very cunning.
Wow, he's a smart man.
Yeah.
That'd be a way to do it.
That would be cool. That would be cool. If somebody could like empty out this instance during the during the class part, so that as soon as we're done and it's time for, yeah. Sorry, I'm like not even fighting here. That's all right. My winks will kill you. No, you killed me first. My winks will avenge me. Okay. Yeah. All right. Let's do that. Okay. So we'll come and I'll look around here next week briefly. And then, not necessarily briefly, but I won't do all the combat. And the other two, I don't really think I need to look at. I mean, the barrows are kind of interesting. Maybe we could look at the barrows, actually. Wouldn't mind looking at the barrows. Come to think of it.
Okay. That's cool.
So we'll look at the barrows. We'll look at this. And then we should be done with Garth and Garwin. And indeed, we should really be done with all of the Lone Lands except for the last bridge, which we're probably not going to get to, but we'll get close to next time, actually. Okay.
I have confidence.
Cool. So we'll plan to do that. So I'm gonna go back out of the instance here. All right. So we'll plan to do that. Maybe we'll end up spending the whole time in those two instances next time. But if not, we can move on to go over towards the last bridge. And then we'll if we don't get to go into the troll shawls, we'll head back up to Angmar. But I think we're actually not bad. We've explored almost every square foot of the Lone Lands and done a complete archaeological survey of the ruins of the Lone Lands while we discussed the encounter at Weathertop.
Yeah.
So anyway, cool.
It's been a good night.
Yeah. Awesome. And so now we'll head into the, and then of course we'll have all of the troll shaws to be exploring while they're traveling through the troll shaws. So who knows? Mm-hmm. We may be able to keep it up all the way to Rivendell. Borijada, I was just asking, do the art devs of the game love my analysis? You know, I don't know if I've never talked to them about it. I mean, I've done a little bit of it with them, and I can tell that they humor me when I do. I kind of feel like I'm being humored, but it's okay. It's like, you know, like don't make any sudden moves and you might not spring. But I don't know. I mean, I've never really asked them. I've never really subjected them to one of these sessions, so I don't really
know. Gosh, I hope they like it.
Like if they watch or something, but
I know they like you.
Well, yeah, exactly. They don't hate me personally, so I guess that's a good sign. That's really kind of all I can ask for, I guess. all right. So we're going to sign off here. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you guys next week. So we'll finish this up. We'll do the instances next week and then off probably towards the troll shaw. So thanks, everybody, for joining us. And I will see you guys next week. Bye now.
All right. Good night.
Night.
Thanks for joining me on this epic exploration of The Lord of the Rings and of Standing Stone's video adaptation of Tolkien's story. If you are having even half the fun I'm having on this journey, I hope you will consider supporting the project by donating at signumuniversity.org/fund.